Good afternoon, good morning, and aloha, everybody. Welcome to the Advocacy Learning Center's bi-monthly affinity discussion. My name is Kata Isari, and I will be the moderator for today's call. And today we are joined by teams from Classes F and Classes G, so welcome to all of you. The last two affinity discussions, we have focused on strengthening our advocacy for deaf women and survivors with disabilities. Today, we're going to more broadly consider what does it mean to be truly accessible in our programs and in our social change advocacy. We'll be continuing our discussion by exploring the intersections of advocacy and accessibility. We know this will be a very thoughtful and thought-provoking dialogue, and we're so excited by all the participants we have in the fishbowl today and our speakers, and we also really want to hear from all of you. We hope today will be a very practical look at how we can strengthen our programs and become better advocates. As always, the affinity calls provide a format where you can have an interactive dialogue among your peers, as much as we can do on a phone call, and we'd like to encourage everyone to share your thoughts, ask your questions, brainstorm ideas together. As you know, you can do this by pressing star 1 to join the conversation, and also by emailing your thoughts to advocacy@praxisinternational.org. To get us started, I'm going to ask Liz to give us more information about the logistics of today's call. Liz?
Hi, Kata. Thank you. And hello, everybody. Just a couple of things to consider today for our discussion. Should you have any questions that you would like to share, questions or comments that you would like to share via email, feel free to send a note to me at any time, and I will make sure to incorporate your comment into the conversation. Send a note to liz@praxisinternational.org, and you can use that same email address if you encounter any sort of technology issues. I'll do my best to help you navigate and get back into the session if you have difficulty. Finally, just a reminder that this call is recorded and will be available on the Protected Class page of our website, so look for it there. That's all I have, Kata.
Great. Thank you, Liz. And so I just want to correct myself. The email address to use, as Liz said, is liz@praxisinternational. It's always so good to have Liz's support and backup on these calls, so I'm glad you're here, Liz. We have a lot of great people that will be helping us with the conversation today, starting with Priya from Manavi and Sandy from Praxis. Hi, Priya and Sandy. Welcome.
Hi. Welcome, everybody.
Hello, everyone.
We also have some of your fellow classmates on the call today in the fishbowl. We have Teresa Fears from the Partnership in Spokane, Washington. Alice Sikora from Deaf Unity in Madison, Wisconsin, and Libby Stanley and Sadie Pyle from Abuse Deaf Women's Advocacy Services in Seattle, Washington. Welcome to all of you, too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Most of you have met Nancy Smith on previous calls in this series. Nancy has been an advocate and activist for many years. Nancy, we're so happy to have you on this call with us again. Can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and the work you've done around these issues?
Sure, I'm happy to. Currently, I work for the Vera Institute of Justice, and we provide training and technical assistance to OVW-funded programs to improve services for survivors of domestic and sexual violence who have disabilities and who are deaf. And I have been working at that intersection of violence and the disability and deaf community since 2001. And through our work, we really try to foster collaborations between domestic violence programs, rape crisis centers, and disability organizations. We also work to improve the accessibility of the programs who are responding to domestic and sexual violence, and then also build leadership opportunities for people with disabilities to be part of our movement to end violence against women.
So that must keep you pretty busy, huh, Nancy?
Absolutely.
Okay, sorry, I was muted for a second there. So, Nancy, before we go on, I'm just going to my muting threw me off. Now I'm going to ask Alice. Alice, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and the work that you do and your involvement in these issues?
Yes, my name is Alice Sikora, and I'm the director of the Deaf Unity in Wisconsin. And Deaf Unity is a statewide organization serving deaf victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. And we've been established since 2008. We're still new, a new organization, compared to ADWAS, who you hear from, or you're going to hear from in a moment. And we've served a variety of deaf victims, female, male, children, a wide variety, that live in rural areas as well as urban. And the experiences as far as being victims and also their experiences in the system, which in rural areas or in the cities are different. There's different challenges. And also, we have a variety of groups. We have a group of Hmong. We have many that live in Wisconsin, and we're dealing with several deaf victims from the Hmong culture. And so that is another layer. And we also have some Hispanic. And actually talking about, we are a deaf organization, but we also come in contact with all a variety of different cultures. And so these two areas intersect. And we do have a staff of one full-time advocate and one part-time, plus some volunteer advocates. And we do a lot of training, community education, presentations, and that's basically what we do.
So you sound like you stay pretty busy too, Alice, right?
Very.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you for telling us about your work and, again, for being here. Libby, how about you? Can you tell us a little bit about your background and the work that you do?
Yes. Hi, this is Libby. I just wanted to let you know that I am deaf and I am using two different interpreters today, so you might hear two different voices from time to time. I have been with ADWAS as a program manager coordinator. I worked for ADWAS since, many years, 9 years now as a community advocate. My role was community advocate, and now I'm in transitional housing. Right now, I'm primarily the program manager, and I've got actually a variety of experiences in a different number of areas. We have a number of staff here. We have an emergency shelter. We have transitional housing, children's programs, adult programs, advocacy programs for each and every one of those groups. We have a hotline. Let me see. We've got quite a few programs here. We have been working with deaf, deafblind, and hard of hearing clients, victims of domestic violence and sexual violence, dating violence and such, probation, all of that. Excuse me, stalking. Thank you for understanding. Let me see. Just like Alice mentioned, we've been working with these clients, deaf people who have been immigrated, undocumented as well as documented, different languages, deaf, deaf-blind, like I mentioned, some that use the same language, American Sign Language, and some that do not. We actually work with a variety of communication modes, just like Alice. So I think that's enough for right now. Okay, thank you.
Great. Thank you, Libby. Also, we definitely have a theme. It doesn't surprise me that we have a lot of very busy advocates and workers on the call, so thank you for that. Teresa, how about you? Can you tell us a little bit about your work that you do?
Sure. I work at the Arc of Spokane, which provides a variety of services to people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. I'm kind of a small program. It's just me. And I provide community awareness and education, and I have a resource fair for students with intellectual and developmental disabilities. I do a community resource guide for families where I collect all the Spokane area resources specific to developmental disabilities. I conduct trainings for professionals. I provide information and support to teachers for comprehensive sexual education training for students with disabilities. I do a healthy relationship education in the classroom. I work with parents whose children have been sexually assaulted. I coordinate with the local sexual assault service center, and I work with the domestic violence center.
Okay, that's a lot, too. Thank you, Teresa. Great to hear about that. And Sadie, I know you work at ADWAS, but could you tell us a little bit about what you do and your involvement in this work?
Yeah, I'm Sadie. I work with Libby at ADWAS. I've been here since 2008. And I'm the children's advocate here, so I work with all of our young folks, birth through 21, who primarily those who live in our transitional housing program, which is an all-accessible to deaf and deafblind communities transitional housing for low-income survivors who are leaving abusive situations. And so through that, I do medical, legal, and educational advocacy, as well as domestic violence work and advocacy with children and their families. And I also go into schools and provide healthy relationships classes in the deaf classrooms in our local schools within King County.
Great. Well, that's so good to hear about. We clearly have a broad range of very skilled and experienced advocates on the call today. So Nancy, Alice, Libby, Teresa, and Sadie, again, thank you so much for being here. Nancy, I know that you had some thoughts about where we might start the conversation today in terms of thinking a little bit about what it means to be working with people with disabilities and deaf and hard of hearing community. You want to throw that out and see where that takes us?
Sure. First off, I just want to say that I'm really honored to be on the call with such wonderful advocates, and I'm familiar with some of your programs, but not all of the work that you do, and that in part is informing the question that I have. I'm really interested to know from each of your perspectives whether you think there is a space at the table for people with disabilities and deaf individuals in the movement to end domestic violence and sexual violence.
Great question, Nancy. Thank you. Why don't we start with Teresa? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that we haven't done a very good job in the past about including people with intellectual and developmental disabilities because awareness of the need really is just on the rise. But I'm working right now with a self-advocate who I hope to prepare to be involved in the sexual abuse prevention programs on the other side of the state. It's something that's at its very beginning, and I think it's very exciting because opportunities are opening up, but it's an area that has traditionally not really represented people with intellectual disabilities.
Okay, thank you, Teresa. Alice, what are your thoughts on Nancy's question?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to take a minute and think about it. I'm a little bit resistant to, you know, take on that label as deaf as a disability. I think it's kind of a paradox. There's two sides to it. I think from the medical perspective is one opinion, and then from the cultural perspective is the other side. And people just look at ears as, you know, an organ of the body. And that's the medical perspective. You know, the purpose of your ear is to listen to music, to you know, people talking, to just get environmental noises and sounds around you. And that's the medical side of the coin. And also, I think there's a really large emphasis on speech, that, you know, our culture really wants deaf children to learn how to speak. And if they're not successful in that, which they aren't most of the time, then, you know, it's kind of like they're labeled as a failure. And there's such a huge emphasis on learning speech as a deaf child. And I think it's important to realize that speech and language are two separate functions. And like I said, speech and language are separate because we as deaf individuals realize that linguistics and our culture are separate from speech. And, you know, they're just two separate things. We do have culture in our community. We use sign language to communicate. And there is a strong culture tied to that. But I just don't, I'm just hesitant to say that deafness is a disability. I think that we need to take the opportunity to educate people on the two sides of this coin. And I really think that what is missing in domestic violence and sexual assault programs is that people think right away I'll get an interpreter, like it's a medical situation. And these kinds of situations aren't like medical situations. There's so much more involved. You can't just get an interpreter and have them there. You need someone who really understands the cultural and linguistic experiences of a deaf individual growing up that can, you know, manage that situation as a domestic violence survivor. And so I'm just trying to really, you know, get that whole perspective in there as a deaf person. I'm sorry, I know I should be brief, but we'll just end it there.
No, please don't apologize, Alice. That was a very thoughtful and helpful response. I'm going to ask a follow-up question to you, if you don't mind, before we go on to Libby and Sadie. But as I'm interjecting, I just really want to encourage everyone who's on the call to let us know what you're thinking and your thoughts, reactions, and questions. Again, you can do that by pressing star 1 or emailing your thoughts or questions to liz@praxisinternational.org. So, Alice, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but based on what you said, it was so helpful in terms of your distinguishing between a medical situation and cultural and linguistic inclusion or work. Would you say then that deaf women are, or deaf survivors are not at the table in violence against women work? What do you think?
Can you say that again?
Nancy's question for us was, you know, has space been made at the table for people with disabilities and for deaf women or survivors? And I think you did a lovely job of distinguishing between disability and the experiences of deaf women and the medical condition, as you described it, versus cultural and linguistic. That distinction was very helpful. And what I wonder is, are you saying that there hasn't been adequate space made at the table in domestic violence and sexual assault work for deaf women and for deaf survivors?
Okay, I just want to clarify. When you say space, I'm not grasping what you mean by that.
I guess it was... Go ahead, Nancy.
Oh, this is Nancy. Alice, you know, for me, one of the things that why I sort of thought of the question is just to think about sort of the importance of having people with disabilities and having deaf individuals be really part of the movement to end violence against women, not just as partners but as leaders. And so I guess, put a different way, I'm wondering, maybe from your personal experience as a deaf advocate, do you feel as though the movement that is out there, you know, made up of all of these different programs and people who are addressing domestic and sexual violence, is open to including people with disabilities and deaf individuals, and sort of welcoming of sort of the of having these communities be part of the movement. Does that help?
Yes, that helps so much. Thank you so much for clarifying. I really appreciate it. The word space was just kind of throwing me off there. Okay, so I think part of the cultural mediation that we go through as deaf individuals, trying to figure out, you know, where we fit in and everything, I think that really just helped me understand the question. So what I would say is that the deaf community has been involved in the movement against domestic violence. Not as much as I would like to see. Luckily, we have a couple of wonderful coalitions that are very, very inclusive. And that has really just changed so much over the previous years, where there's been so much more inclusion for the deaf community and for our community members at large. I mean, there hasn't been a real formal outreach for the deaf community. There haven't been seminars as of yet. There hasn't been a strong women's movement. Any kind of impetus for change like that we haven't seen as of yet in general. But I feel like the deaf culture seems to try and stay within their own community. And I think that hopefully these ongoing seminars are kind of causing a little food for thought within the community, where we realize that as deaf individuals, we can take on leadership roles and we can affect change. I think there hasn't been that much awareness as of yet as to the power that we have. And I think that the coalitions for domestic violence and sexual assault will really, really get the ball rolling and will cause more inclusion in the deaf community.
Thank you, Alice. That's I appreciate both your honesty and your perspective on that. It sounds, if I'm correct, I'm just going to check with you, that you're saying there's been some good work and still a lot more that needs to be done. Would that be correct?
Exactly.
Great. Thank you. Libby, what are your thoughts on this question that Nancy's tossed out to us?
Yes, this is Libby. I will have to agree with Alice on her analysis. Really, there is more progress that needs to be made. But in our state, unfortunately, really both the coalitions for sexual violence and domestic violence, they are checking in with ADWAS and such. They do have some representation. They do have interpreters ready and things, and that's good. They do have good quality interpreters also. So we don't have to make do with, you know, the lesser quality interpreters. But at the same time, other states maybe do not have these things. They do not have services for deaf individuals at all, like ADWAS. There is no organization out there for deaf people, and so the other states are really, unfortunately, behind. Often in my experience, as it relates to deaf people being equal in the mainstream society, I would say that that's not the case. It is lacking in that area. It is quite a struggle. The issue is, how can they make these programs accessible for deaf people? How can these programs provide interpreting services or otherwise to create that equality? Some programs don't have money to hire interpreters or to get interpreters at all, possibly. They might only have enough money for a very unqualified interpreter, or maybe even a student interpreter, to be able to provide any service at all. And so that definitely doesn't provide the equality, and they don't feel that they're represented and included equally with other individuals.
Thank you, Libby. That's really a helpful perspective. Sadie, I wonder what your thoughts are on this question.
Yeah, I think it's really useful to hear a lot of that distinction in how people with disabilities and how deaf people are viewed, either in a problem or a less way or in a contribution or cultural perspective. And I think along with that, the services I see provided, we're pretty fortunate, like Libby said, in Washington State to have folks who are really on board with getting interpreters present for all of our conferences and meetings and doing a lot of really wonderful things. And so I applaud that, and I think that's really significant. I think it's important that people are getting that spaces and environments and sounds and scents that need to be accessible. With that, I think there's the cultural piece, there's sort of the heart that sometimes is missing, because that you can't write down heart on a checklist and have that make sense to people. And so by that, I think I mean not just making sure that they're interpreters, but making sure that a perspective of what it's like to experience domestic and sexual violence as a deaf person is a part of a conversation. So language and relevance access, or so that in addition to having wheelchair accessible ramps in a space that make it so that folks who are in wheelchairs can show up, that the conversation and dialogue and the way that people are with each other is inclusive and valuing of that person's participation beyond just making it. And sometimes I think that even means getting people to the table. So I have seen people write down that there will be ASL interpretation at an event, or write that an event is sent free as an accessibility thing, but not actually reach out to those communities to invite them specifically and let them know that when they show up, in addition to providing accessibility, that their perspective and their voice is going to be honored and really welcome and celebrated as part of that conversation.
Thank you, Sadie. Again, really helped to round out our discussion on this topic. Nancy, I wonder what your thoughts and responses are as you hear our advocates talk about your question.
You know, I really relate to a lot of what everyone has said, just sort of having the opportunity to work with a number of communities around the country and travel around and talk both to, you know, advocates in the movement and then also talking to people with disabilities. I think, you know, one thing I would say is that there's certainly variation across the country. So there are some places where there's been more intentionality and you see a lot more progress, like in the state of Washington, for example. And I think there's other places who haven't begun to make the connection between disability and the deaf community and domestic and sexual violence. And so those, you know, there may be, there are more kind of barriers and challenges, and, you know, that people with disabilities and deaf individuals don't have a space at the table in those areas. You know, one of the things that I think is sort of implicit in what everyone was saying is that, you know, there's a lot of work being done within the deaf community. There's a lot of work being done within the disability community, especially among self-advocates, to address issues of violence. And sometimes that is connected to the movement, you know, what we think of as the movement to end violence against women, and sometimes it's disconnected. And to me, there's real promise of really being intentional about connecting the two so that we can kind of, you know, build off one another's efforts to end violence against women.
A little more about that last point, Nancy.
Yeah, just that, you know, I do think that there's a lot of work happening, for example, in the deaf community and also among self-advocates to address violence that may not be connected to mainstream domestic violence programs or to mainstream rape crisis centers. And that, you know, any time in which I think we're fragmented in our efforts, you know, I don't think we're being as effective as we could. So I think one hope that I would have is that, you know, we figure out ways to sort of work from one another, but also figuring out ways to learn from one another. And I think there's a lot of really innovative practices, for example, just, you know, not to go off on a tangent here, but some innovative practices within the deaf community, for example, on community accountability. And, you know, there's a lot of real strengths that you get from having a small community like the deaf community, where you're able to be innovative in how you're thinking about ending violence against women. And, you know, because of the barriers between the communities, between the deaf community and sort of the hearing community, I think that our advocacy in the hearing community hasn't been able to sort of learn from the lessons within the deaf community and some of the innovative practices that are there. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense. Thank you for that example. That's very helpful. I want to, again, just take a moment and remind our participants that we'd love to hear your thoughts and your questions and your experiences on the topic that our speakers are discussing today. And you can join the conversation by pressing star 1, and the operator will have you come into the call, or you can email your thoughts or comments to liz@praxisinternational.org. You know, in listening to what everyone has been saying, Alice mentioned the importance of leadership in this work by deaf women and deaf advocates and survivors, and Libby mentioned that the issue of not being in the mainstream, and Nancy gave us some other very potent examples, as did Teresa and Sadie, that I'm reminded of the conversations that we had during the immersion training for all of our classes about the issues of privilege and power, and how privilege often puts us in a place where we aren't fully prepared to be responsive to individuals and groups that don't have the same privilege that we do. And that was something that was raised in the publicity for this call. And so I wonder if we should go to that question and hear from everybody what their thoughts are about what knowledge or understanding do we in the hearing community of advocates need to ensure that we're aware of our privilege and how that privilege may impact our work with women and survivors who don't share that same privilege. Nancy, do you want to start us off on this, and then we'll go to the fishbowl participants and see what their thoughts are?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind for me is not quite going to knowledge, but going to experience and the experience that comes from knowledge. And for me, you know, when I think about sort of the privilege that we have, you know, I go back to how invisible people with disabilities and deaf people are, how invisible they've been historically, and then also how invisible they've continued to be. And so because of that invisibility, I think the concept of privilege around sort of being able-bodied or being hearing is new to a lot of people. I know it was new to me sort of 10 years ago when I started working at this intersection. And I think it is, you know, unless you are connecting with people with disabilities and deaf people, and you're building relationships and you're understanding their experiences, it's hard to recognize privilege in this area. And, you know, I think through those understanding of people's experiences, you can begin to kind of develop an analysis that you bring around in the world to scan for, you know, ableism and autism and the privilege that we do have as able-bodied hearing people.
And Nancy, if you're willing to say, what helped you recognize your own privilege in this area?
Well, I can pinpoint the day, actually, that I really had, for lack of better terms, an aha moment around the hearing privilege that I have. For example, I was actually convening a roundtable of advocates who were addressing domestic violence and sexual violence in both the disability community and the deaf community. And there was a deaf advocate who was part of the roundtable, and there were several American Sign Language interpreters who were contracted to work the event. And about halfway into the roundtable, which was a really rich discussion about sort of the experiences of deaf survivors and survivors with disabilities and what we needed to do as a movement to be better in terms of meeting their needs. And halfway through the roundtable, the interpreters stopped interpreting. And I, you know, noticed that something was happening because they were not signing to the deaf participant that we had. And I called a break, and I was really, you know, struggling to understand what I should do in that moment because I did not know American Sign Language. I wasn't sure how to communicate directly with the deaf advocate. I knew that there was something wrong. And I turned to the interpreters who were, you know, spoke English and were hearing, and I asked them what was happening. And they started talking very negatively about the deaf advocate who was at the table, which was a real signal to me that something was wrong. And so I went to talk to the deaf advocate who told me that they were just horrible interpreters, that they weren't interpreting. And in that moment, I recognized how much power and privilege I had. I was able to communicate with everyone in that room. I was also able to make decisions about what would happen next. I was able to decide whether the meeting went on. I was able to decide whether what we did with those interpreters because of sort of the privileges that I've had in my life and the position of power that I was in. And it really started to open my eyes to the experiences of deaf people and communication access. And so at that moment, for sure, is a huge moment in my life of beginning a journey of being a hearing ally.
Thank you, Nancy. I appreciate your honestly sharing about that experience. It is, I think, a very important part of our work to be allies, whatever our privilege area is to begin to recognize our own privilege. I want to pull in other folks into this conversation. Libby, do you have thoughts on this issue of privilege and how to be conscious of privilege in working with deaf women? Go ahead.
This is Libby, and I definitely have two thoughts. First of all, in regards to the interpreting and the interpreters for a deaf person. You know, I'm deaf myself, and I've worked with deaf survivors. So it's interesting to see, I have a perspective in regards to how the mainstream people respond to having an interpreter. You know, if you go to a doctor's appointment or workshop or a meeting, it doesn't really matter where you go. If, for example, you could just cancel last minute or not show up, that's great. It doesn't cost the people anything. However, for a deaf person, if I were to cancel, they would have to pay for the interpreter likely still, and they don't like that. You know, I paid for the interpreter for this appointment, and the agency may be a little bit upset that I did not show up. Therefore, they're paying for an interpreter, although I'm not using the service. So I think for deaf people, there's more planning involved. You always have to think about that. You have to think about the cost of the interpreter and the scheduling of the interpreter, and you feel a little bit guilty, like you feel like you can't just cancel an appointment last minute because of that. So that is definitely an added, you know, yeah, you have to think about those things. A hearing person doesn't do that. If you don't want to go to the doctor, you don't want to make a meeting, you just call and tell them you're not coming. And there is no less of an impact for hearing people than there is for deaf people. So that's one thought I had in regards to the interpreter when Nancy was talking about the situation. Another example that I have in regards to accessibility and domestic violence, for example, there's a meeting on domestic violence. There was hearing people involved, and deaf people in this meeting, and we were providing cell phones for survivors to use if they need to call 911 for emergency purposes. So we were handing out cell phones, and I looked at this phone, and I thought, this is not deaf-friendly at all. These phones are for hearing people. It does not match deaf people's needs. So we're providing a service that is not helpful, and then I felt guilty and I felt horrible that passing out these phones was not really helpful to our deaf consumers. Deaf survivors do not have the same kind of resources that hearing survivors have. We have to, you know, go back to, again, more strategizing, more planning to come up with things. So equality is not necessarily an easy task.
Thank you, Libby. That's a very powerful final comment you made, that equality is not an easy task, and a good reminder for all of us. So I appreciate your thoughts on that. I just want to acknowledge that we are having some technical difficulties with Alice's line, so we're working on reconnecting Alice to the call. But while we're doing that, I want to continue.
Hi, this is Alice. I'm back on the call now.
Hey, oh, I'm so glad.
But I did miss part of the discussion. I did catch Sadie and Libby, but at the very beginning, I don't know what the question was and what led to their responses.
Okay. Well, I'm so glad you're back. Welcome back, and I'm sorry about that. The technology is such a challenge at times. We are having a conversation.
I'll fight to get back in.
Yeah, good for you. We're having a conversation about privilege and the privilege that hearing advocates have that may influence their work with women survivors that are deaf or hard of hearing, or the privilege that advocates have when they are in a different community context, they don't have disabilities, and then work with people who have disabilities. So we're going around the circle. Why don't we go to Sadie and Teresa, and then we'll go to you, Alice, so that you have a little chance to absorb the conversation, given that you got cut off. Sadie, do you have thoughts that you want to add in to this conversation?
Yeah, I really appreciate what everyone has been saying. I think it's really, really valuable, and I really connected with what Libby was saying about the interpreter need and the impact that that has, not just getting interpreters, but what it's like for a room, for a hearing group, to the expectations of the deaf person in that space. So I was remembering another example of being with a deaf person. As a hearing advocate myself and working in the deaf community, I was with a colleague out at a meeting, and, you know, the meeting was not interesting, and she was kind of bored, and she was not attentively staring at the interpreter the whole time, just in the same way that hearing people are used to zoning in and out of conversations, turning on and off your ears a little bit more, depending on how engaged you are at that moment, or maybe if you're thinking about what you're cooking for dinner that night. And everyone in the room was paying attention to the fact that my deaf coworker wasn't catching the information that minute because her eyes looked away. And a couple of people actually called her out on it and asked her to pay attention again by noticing that she wasn't watching the interpreter. And I think just the awareness of hearing people of what's going on for deaf people and the expectation of attentiveness is so different than what we expect for ourselves as hearing people. And I think it's really easy to overlook the impact of that, because, of course, the experience of privilege makes it so that all of the ways we experience privilege are invisible to ourselves until we're really asked to address them.
That's a wonderful point, Sadie. Thank you. I think about how many times I hear people mutter about someone in a meeting being on their cell phone and texting, and yet I don't think I've ever heard someone address that directly. And so that just really highlights that when we have privilege, we tend to only see and experience the world from our experience of privilege rather than being able to acknowledge the power that that gives us. Teresa, I know you work with a slightly different aspect here, but I wonder what your thoughts are on this issue of privilege and how that impacts our work as advocates.
Well, I really liked the observation that people in the deaf community and people with intellectual disabilities are pretty well invisible. And I actually had a recent experience of that where I had a volunteer with me at a training, and she has Down syndrome, so her disability was pretty obvious. And she raised her hand to speak, and nobody, including the teacher, acknowledged that her hand was raised. And she sat there for a good 5 minutes with her hand up. So finally I had to stick my hand up, then wave it around a little bit. But people were turning and looking at her and then ignoring her. And that's not an unusual experience. And for people with intellectual disabilities, this complete disregard of their presence. And I think it has a lot to do with policies of isolation and separation. If you don't grow up experiencing that population, you don't know what to do with it. And the other concern I have is with not acknowledging low literacy skills. For example, I was doing a review form with an agency recently, and they had their intake paperwork that clients would sign in several languages, but in the English form, it was written at a college level. And I asked that they have a low literacy form, and I said, what do you do for people who can't comprehend a plus 12 grade vocabulary? Oh, well, they said, we explain it to them. It's like, that's not legal. Well, our advocates just explain it to them. So, you know, they're not having a Spanish person come in and reinterpret the form from English to Spanish each time a Spanish-speaking person comes in. But if you have a low literacy rate, they don't give you a form you can understand. They tell you it's in the form that you can't understand, and then they ask you to sign it. And the fact that they were resistant to coming up with a low literacy form just smacked of privilege to me. It was too inconvenient. The lawyers didn't like it, and they didn't do it.
Very important, specific example. Thank you for that, Teresa. You said policies of isolation and separation. Can you tell us a little more what you meant about that?
Well, it starts with the it starts at birth with identifying perhaps physical education needs or rehabilitation needs. So children with disabilities tend not to end up in play groups with children without disabilities. They end up in specialized care groups. And then when they get into school, they're pulled out of the regular classroom and put into a separate classroom. And then when they are in probably high school, late high school, and this was a big surprise to me, many students are moved out of their family homes and into state institutions called adult family homes, which are really not stable forms of housing because you're in a home with six other people. They may be as old as 70 or 80 years old, so you may not even be in a home with other teenagers. And then you may move hundreds of times, literally, during your lifetime between licensed facilities. I know young people who've been to two or three adult family homes during their high school career. That's not a normative experience, and that's not a mainstream experience. So separated from the general population and then isolated through policies like if the adult family home doesn't want to take you someplace and you haven't been given bus training, you don't go anywhere. In fact, we had an adult family home closed down because their idea of an outing was to force everybody to go to their church on Sunday, regardless of religious affiliation. Did that answer your question?
That did. Those are very graphic and very clear examples. I appreciate that. So, Alice, let's pull you into this conversation now about privilege and hear your thoughts or reactions to what anyone else has said so far. What do you think?
Yes, I'd like to echo what Libby and Sadie have mentioned so far. And I think that more mature people feel the responsibility to, how do I say this, even if they don't want to go to a meeting and it comes up at the last minute, we feel that huge burden of responsibility to go to the meeting. Like Libby had mentioned, we don't have that option of canceling at the last minute. For the webinars that I've been involved in for the past years, I've been watching on the screen for 2 hours. I watch an interpreter. I can't do other tasks at the same time. I can't multitask. I can't focus on my work at the same time. And, I mean, the last webinar, I felt like my eyes were going to fall out of my head. I mean, it's exhausting. It's mentally exhausting to watch an interpreter on screen for hours on end. It's a difficult part of being a deaf individual. There are, you know, talking with another deaf person, just signing, you know, casually and, you know, one-on-one, face-to-face, that's a different situation. But watching an interpreter on screen for 2 hours is really taxing on you physically. And so I think that really puts a big burden on deaf people. also, myself as a deaf educator and a leader in domestic violence services here, I feel like if there is an interpreter there, or if there's a person who can hear and speak well enough, like this is just an example, if there's a hard of hearing person involved in something, I feel like the interpreter always goes with that person instead of with me, because that hearing person, or hard of hearing person, excuse me, has that little bit of hearing privilege. And I mean, it's just, they still do wonderful work, of course, but it just seems to happen all the time. I'll say hello to the interpreter, and immediately they are drawn to that hard of hearing person because they can communicate with them easier. It's like they're on the same level more so than when they communicate with me. And, you know, I'm a strong advocate. I have an important role here, and I feel like I deserve the same respect as any of my peers here, and that sometimes I don't get that. Also, I just want to add, those are just, that's it. Those are my 2 cents I had.
Was there something else, Alice?
Nope, I'm done.
Okay. Well, again, thank you, as with everyone, for your honesty, because I think this is very important in the conversation and considerations we're having today.
Anna?
Yes?
This is Sadie. I just wanted to add one more piece. I think all the folks in Class F with me know that I'm a hearing advocate and I work in a deaf agency. And so I guess I want to speak to a little bit to the experience of privilege that just happens on a daily basis, not necessarily in a situation or with a client or what it's compared to the deaf experience, but just that even within my daily work, so I'm working in American Sign Language with my colleagues, with my the survivors who come in here and the families, and still we have regularly conversations on our staff. There's a group of the hearing folks who work here. We have, I think, 6 out of the 20 staff are hearing. And we have groups every so often to kind of talk about what the experience is like of how we're experiencing our own privilege, asking each other to call us out on what's going on within the agency. We have we're confronted with issues with our deaf coworkers somewhat regularly, things that come up that maybe as a hearing advocate I would just not even recognize or remember is something that I assume about my life, a piece of privilege. And so even having done this work for 5 years and having been in and around the deaf community longer than that, like, privilege doesn't go away. And I think we all know that, and that's something I appreciate about the conversations in the ALC is that we're understanding that privilege isn't something that goes away. It's something that we focus our attention on more sometimes than others. And so I just encourage ourselves and everybody we know to continue asking questions and continue thinking of ourselves as learners in that way. Because, of course, as privilege is invisible to us until our attention is drawn to it, it's really easy to not get that it's going on. So for me, it's helpful to be around a group that's willing to tell me what's going on or tell me what they're noticing about me and my behavior, and I appreciate when that happens. And so I'm hopeful that other people are reaching out to communities with disabilities and reaching out to the deaf community locally to develop relationships that are strong enough that can hold that conversation when something isn't working.
Thank you, Sadie. That's so important. Not surprisingly, but all of you have just these wonderful gems of statements that are really resonating with me, and that phrase that you just said, that privilege doesn't go away, I think is so important, and it speaks to what a lot of you have raised about being conscious and intentional and present with all of the implications of today's conversation. Nancy, I know you have a lot of experience in providing technical assistance to programs all over the country to help them become more aware and accessible in terms of identifying privilege that may unintentionally or intentionally, we've heard a little bit today, limit their accessibility. And I'm going to ask you to speak to that, but I'm just remembering to remind our participants to let us know your thoughts by pressing *1 and joining the conversation or emailing your questions or comments to Liz at praxisinternational.org. But Nancy, what are your thoughts as you consider what everyone has been sharing about what advocates and programs can do to address privilege in their work?
Well, I think some of it has been touched on. I mean, for me, a starting point is first kind of stepping back a little bit and understanding where privilege comes from and really starting to have conversations about oppression against people with disabilities and oppression against deaf people and really begin to better understand ableism and autism. Because I think, you know, those two kind of forms of oppression really are sort of the root of all of this. And I think that, you know, stemming from ableism and autism is this assumption that there is a norm and that the norm is able-bodied and the norm is hearing. And, you know, a couple things I think stem from that. You know, one is values placed on kind of those categories. So we have a lot of negative stereotypes and pity and fear and patronizing being associated with, you know, people who are not the norm. And I think that also from that, you know, we really have designed really almost all aspects of society from that assumption of who the norm is. And that includes our own programs, and it includes, you know, how we advocate around issues of domestic sexual violence and how we work with survivors and you know, everything from that to sort of how we host community events. And, you know, so one, I think, is recognizing that and having conversations about that and kind of reflecting on how we've been impacted by ableism and autism, because we are all a part of that, and it is a part of our value system, and being really self-reflective and beginning to challenge that, as I think was just mentioned, certainly is a first piece for me that has been very important for programs across the country. And I think next to that is really connecting with people with disabilities and deaf individuals, again, to better understand their experiences, but also because I think people with disabilities and deaf people are their best experts about what they need in terms of our approaches being accessible to them. And if you don't have those relationships and you haven't started working with them, I think it's very difficult to be successful in sort of our goal of wanting to be accessible and wanting to meet every survivor where they are at. So those are just two things that kind of come to mind to me.
Thanks, Nancy. I want to pull in other people too, but can you please define autism for us? That may be a term that some folks on the call haven't heard yet.
Sure. I can give a very basic, but then I would really defer to the deaf folks on the call. To me, it is obviously it's a set of a system of oppression that discriminates against deaf people in favor of people who are hearing. And I think much like ableism, autism treats hearing people as the standard, and it sees people who are deaf as abnormal and really excludes those folks from society in a wide variety of ways. And I think it also privileges spoken language over signed language, for sure. But again, I want to open it up to the rest of the folks on the call.
Oh, well, this is Alice. I'd be happy to make a comment on that.
Go ahead, Alice.
I'll just interrupt you for one moment. I think that autism, it's not like autism. I don't want people to be confused about that. It's autism with a D, as in dog. When people hear that, I've made presentations on autism before, and I just want to, first of all, make that distinction. AUD is from auditory, which, you know, anything related to the ear and sound. So the beginning of the word, aud, is auditory, and then ism, as Nancy nicely explained, it's discrimination. It's the attitude and the practice. by hearing people, by hearing society and their approach to educating, serving the deaf community as a whole. And it's, you know, the comparison that the society is just spoken language and audio based. That is the whole basis of our society. And, you know, and it's based on the fact that everyone should be able to hear.
Thank you, Alice. Libby, anything you want to add to that definition or description?
This is Libby. Yes, just a minor emphasis here. Yes, it's definitely about attitude. It's really about any ism, any societal ism, you know, using language like English is better than sign language. And we say this is what society is based on, the use of English, speaking it and hearing it. Autism happens in the deaf community. They might be able to hear some, they might be able to speak some, and those people in the deaf community might feel more of a camaraderie with the hearing culture. Those who don't speak, those who use ASL, will be more involved in their own community, but not so much as in mainstream society. I just want to clarify that that does even happen within the deaf community, and it has been going on systemically for a long time.
Thank you, Libby. So while you're speaking, let me ask you, and then I'll go to the other folks in the fishbowl, if you have anything to add to Nancy's suggestions about how programs can identify and address privilege when considering accessibility.
This is Libby. As it relates to identifying, well, the one great way is to do the program evaluation regularly. Consult with deaf service providers. They can evaluate your program very well. Maybe they'll be able to identify some things that you're completely unaware of because it's probably part of your regular everyday process. Here at ADWAS, we look forward to our evaluation. We have a service from LGT Services that comes in and evaluates and helps us analyze if our services are truly providing accessibility to the LGBTQ community. So we have that evaluation that comes in here and happens. We also have collaborations. Collaborations are so important with deaf providers and non-deaf providers. Let me see if there's anything else I want to add. I think that's all I can think of right now.
That's really helpful, Libby. Can you say a little bit more about the program evaluation? It sounds like ADWAS does that with other communities, but how did that get started? What would be a place that programs for listening could initiate that?
Okay. Well, right now in Washington State, we have a project that's focused on how to improve services for GLBTQ community members. That's just starting. It's not something that's been going on a long time. And we can have those groups come in and survey each staff member and evaluate our roles in the agency. And it helps. It's based on their questions. I couldn't tell you an example of what that might be exactly right at this moment. I'm thinking that it probably applies to deaf services in some way also, but I'm not actually sure. I don't have something in front of me. We haven't finished it. I think maybe Alice knows a little bit more about it, but in Washington State, anyway, we have this evaluation that's related to service providers with disabilities and survivors with disabilities, and then also hard of hearing services and deaf services. I'm thinking that I would have to check on their website to see if that information is still accessible from Washington State Coalition Against Domestic Violence. I'm pretty sure the information is there. I did take some training from them a few years ago. I'm sure that that would be worth looking at again, but doing an evaluation that is based 100% on deaf and hard of hearing community members, I don't know that that's completely possible, but I don't know if anybody here has completed any program evaluations that they might be willing to share, just evaluations that might be related to certain aspects of your service, like communication, or is there a budget for interpreters already allocated, or do you have a contact list for interpreters already ready that can be accessed at a moment's notice? Another thing would be the paperwork at the front desk. Has that been evaluated so that a person can come in and fill that out at their level? Video phones, for example. Is there something like that in the office so that a communication can be clear over the phone? Do you have staff members who can sign? Is the communication based on written paper and pencil? Are the brochures in large print or in Braille accessible for deaf-blind individuals? Maybe the bulletin board. Are there advertisements there for deaf events or services from the community other than your particular program? There's a national domestic violence hotline phone number. You know, there might be a brochure or something that could be put on your bulletin board about that. All of these things are examples of things that could be evaluated when doing a program evaluation.
Hi, this is Teresa. I did get online today because I was curious about whether WICSAP still had that information that you were referring to, and in fact they do. And I captured their internet address, and I thought I could send that along to Praxis so maybe they could make that available to everybody. And I also checked the Washington State Coalition Against Domestic Violence because they have a distance learning course and quite a lot of information on providing services to people with developmental disabilities like safety plans. And I also captured that internet address in case people were interested in that as well.
Thank you, Teresa. That's really helpful, Anna, and we can definitely make that information and those links available on the website to, it sounded like, the Washington Coalition of Sexual Assault Programs as well as the Washington State Domestic Violence Coalition. And while you're speaking, Teresa, do you have other thoughts on this issue around what programs can do? Libby's given us some wonderful examples, as have Nancy and Alice, and we'll go back to other folks. But what are your thoughts?
Well, they all said it, really. It's you have to inform yourself with the research and the literature and find out what's going on, and then you have to be with the people. The people teach you what you need to know. You can't do this in isolation.
Okay, great summary. Thank you. Alice, anything you want to add in?
Yes, there's two things. One's regarding to or related to what Libby said, going back to the question of privilege. This One State Coalition here, they did a program accessibility analysis of different programs, and that included deaf, some of them, but no deaf evaluators as part of the evaluating team for the on-site evaluation. And so to me, that's just a good example of, you know, not including a deaf person in the evaluation process, and the policies and the protocols, making sure they fit with deaf people. So to me, that's just one example. And if a program needs to be accessible, then they need to go to the state coalition and set up standards. I think that's where the leadership happens. And my other point is that I've been working, actually I've been developing a MOUS with some programs, and we have different points that we've agreed on, and we're teaching and training how to be culturally competent. And that was our service, and we're emphasizing advocacy with the coalition and being able to advocate well is part of
understanding the
cultural aspect of the victims. And so we've agreed and that we'll do these specific things, and we just want to make sure the accessibility and there's cultural competency for the victim. And I think that that is a way to go as far as making sure that a program is truly accessible for deaf victims. And I do have a connection with the deaf agency or a deaf domestic violence agency organizations.
Thank you, Alice. Those are very helpful suggestions also. And it reminds me, as I'm listening to you and other people talk about the some of the core principles of social change advocacy that we focus on so much at Praxis, and in particular recognizing the intersection and complexity of survivors' lives when we work with them. And a lot of what people are saying really speak to that. Sadie, do you have thoughts that you want to chime in on this conversation?
I think folks have said a great job of different ideas about that. One, a couple of resources that I think are important. One is the National Domestic Violence Hotline provides or can provide technical assistance to programs who just want to sort of talk through some of what they're experiencing working with deaf or deafblind survivors. So calling, there's a deaf-specific hotline that they can call. Folks can call Monday through Friday, 9 to 5 Pacific Standard Time, and talk with deaf advocates about barriers or reducing barriers for deaf and deafblind survivors. And then what Teresa said about the Washington State Coalition Against Domestic Violence, they have a tab called Resources, and they actually do have some of those checklists that can help in planning a meeting, so thinking about the need for interpreters or publicizing or bathroom location in relation to the meeting room, some of the things that as able-bodied or hearing people we might not have even known to consider. They also have a whole worksheet on considering the font that you're typing in to make your documents more readable for people. So those resources are great. And then the other piece that I know several folks have touched on is interpreters. And I heard Nancy and Libby specifically both speak to interpreters and the challenge of knowing if interpreters are quality, what that is looking like. So I know we're fortunate that some of our the agencies we collaborate with in Seattle will ask us if they're working with a deaf survivor what interpreters might be great, or if they're working with our staff, what interpreters they should bring on. But there are some interpreters who are really incredible at business meetings but terrible at working with kids, or who are just great at understanding people who have minimal language, maybe just moved here from another country and are just learning American Sign Language as opposed to their home sign language. And the interpreter might be awesome at that, but not as good at understanding or being able to provide professional, like business meeting conversation. So asking the deaf folks in your community who is great at doing what and being able to really provide services, and then asking survivors, finding a way of communicating with the survivor separate from the interpreter to find out if the interpreting is meeting their needs in that situation, I think is really a useful tool.
Thank you, Sadie. I appreciate that everyone who's speaking today is giving such concrete and specific ideas and examples. I'm hoping that's very helpful for our listeners and participants. Again, I want to encourage our participants to let us know what you're thinking, and if you have questions or issues you'd like to raise for discussion or comments, to press star 1 and join the conversation, or to email liz@praxisinternational.org. Nancy, I want to check in with you now. I know we've talked about a lot of varied issues in terms of accessibility, and I'm wondering if there's anything else that you suggest that we consider as programs or advocates as we think about accessibility.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when we think about accessibility, it's incredibly diverse. So today we've been talking a lot about access for the deaf community and access for folks who have intellectual disabilities. And just maybe a reminder to for us all to remember that, you know, there are a wide array of disabilities that exist, and there's a lot of very specific examples for, you know, the sort of thousands of disabilities that exist, whether it be folks who have learning disabilities or physical disabilities or mental health concerns. And so there really is a broad spectrum of things to consider. And just building on some of the comments that were shared already and some of the excellent resources, the Washington State Coalition's materials have been adapted to expand that idea of sort of a checklist or of a tool that you can use to assess your accessibility to a wide number of types of disabilities. So there's a checklist that I know of specifically for survivors with mental health concerns. There's also checklists that exist for folks with developmental disabilities, and I'm happy to provide those types of those resources as well so that folks can have access to those. And the one last thing that I would think about, you know, we've talked a lot about the importance of collaboration and working with people with disabilities and deaf individuals and also disability and deaf organizations. And having had the opportunity to work now with a little more than 50 or so collaborations between those different types of organizations, I would also just say that, you know, the collaborations can be very equitable, and just as those organizations have a lot to bring to domestic violence advocates, I think domestic violence advocates have a lot to bring to disability organizations, for example, in, you know, raising awareness about domestic violence and sexual assault, and in providing what it means to provide safe referrals, what it means to do with some safety planning with the folks that they're seeing. So I do want everyone to keep in mind that it's a two-way street, because I think sometimes it can get overwhelming to think about, you know, all the changes that we have to make, and, you know, but we have expertise too, and I think it's essential that they're both put together to best kind of meet the needs of folks with disabilities and deaf individuals.
That's an important reminder. Thank you, Nancy. Certainly this is, as we talk so much at the Advocacy Learning Center, this is a collective work on all of our part to engage together around ending violence against women and children, and something that we all share with each other, and certainly it's good to know that it can be an exchange for all of us. We are coming towards the end of our time together, so I'm going to invite each of our participants in the fishbowl and then Nancy to just give us some final thoughts or comments that you'd like to leave our listeners with today as we think about what we hope, what you hope people will take away from this conversation. Teresa, do you want to start us off with a final thought or comment that you'd like people to take away from the conversation today?
Oh, that's a good question. I just think reaching out to agencies that provide services to people with disability and including them in planning for services is going to be beneficial for everybody, and I don't see a lot of that happening. So I guess I would encourage people to include those organizations in your development and planning stage for your services and programs. Ta-da, that's it.
That's great, Teresa. Thank you. I am going to go to the other people in the fishbowl, but we just got a comment from our one of our participants that I'd like to read to people. And this comes from Vanessa Acevedo. And in, where is it? Looks like Washington State. I hope that's correct, Vanessa. I haven't joined in because there's really nothing I can say that hasn't already been addressed. I'm really grateful at the mind-opening concepts and considerations that I am learning about today, and I'm understanding how this can be better applied at our agency. For example, we have included LGBTQ training in our monthly staff trainings, and I'm now realizing how significant it is that we didn't add a mandatory training on the people with disabilities and differently abled individuals. We are certainly lacking in services, resources, accommodations in this area, and the fact that we feel it's something we can put off, although we recognize it's important, speaks to the, quote, abled and, quote, hearing privilege that is occurring. Thank you for opening my eyes to that especially. Thank you, Vanessa, for sending in that comment, and it's actually perfect timing as we are wrapping up and hearing a final thought or comment from each of our speakers. So, Teresa, thank you for the closing consideration. Sadie, do you have a closing thought or comment you'd like to leave people with today?
Yeah, I think the piece of this conversation that feels really important to me right now is that these are the survivors that we're already serving. So I think sometimes in this conversation it's easy to talk about a community as this other community that is happening out there or that we haven't connected with yet or something. And the survivors we're serving already are people with disabilities and are people who are deaf and part of the deaf community. And, you know, there are folks of color that we're serving who also have disabilities, and there are queer folks that we're serving who are also deaf. And so this is already part of our daily work. And these tools are really an opportunity for us to center it and to acknowledge that the whole piece of the survivor that we're serving and the complexity of the multiple identities that all of us hold and make more space for survivors to be able to bring that whole self into our agencies to get really what's meeting their needs.
Okay, thank you, Sadie. Libby, do you have a final thought or comment you'd like to leave people with today?
I was just thinking about that. How agencies can, you know, test out, well, evaluation, I really should say, evaluation, evaluate their program. You know, we all, myself included, we don't want to test it on survivors. You know what I mean? See how this might work with the next survivor that comes in here that's deaf or deafblind and see how it goes. Use them as a test subject. We really want to avoid doing that and putting them through that. You know, we don't want to be doing this by trial and error on each person that comes to us. Agencies need to find, I'm not sure how to say it, but a collaboration, a center, something, a domestic violence center or whatever. I'm not even sure how to say it. It doesn't have to be a certain agency that can come to your program and do a trial with you, you know, to see how it would be for them to go through it, do it together, and see what services they are able to access as a potential survivor instead of putting a real survivor through that, you know, because each person that comes to us is going to be different. We don't want to be testing it out on them. You know, we want to be doing this trial and error not on survivors. We want to be doing it prior to that.
So important. Thank you, Libby. Alice, how about you? A final thought or comment?
Oh, my gosh, I have so many thoughts. Oh, let's see. Just recently
Deaf Unity,
We lost an opportunity to work with a deaf survivor
at a hearing shelter.
We just couldn't really, you know, make the connection with each other. And finally, did connect. but then we lost the survivor. The person had already left the program, and it happens all the time. And so any program that serves death victims or survivors can be effective, but they still can lose the opportunity to serve a deaf person. So, I mean, the key really is collaboration early, not later. And, oh, you know, not later or never, but early. And I've seen so many deaf people that have just kind of faded out of the system because of lack of action. So that is really, I just really want to, you know, impress on everybody the need to continue the discussions and the collaborating. So, and I'm really excited that these webinars, I mean, I think these are really important that we can all learn about the different intersections. And so, and to be able to understand and serve our populations because, I mean, you know, and also to achieve equality for the communities. Thank you.
Thank you, Alice. That is so essential. And I share your excitement. I really appreciate what everyone has said today. Nancy, do you have a final thought for us before we wrap up?
I would just leave everyone with the motto of the disability rights movement, which is nothing about us without us. And I think, as we've all talked about, it's just incredibly essential that deaf individuals and people with disabilities are central and are leaders in the work that we're doing.
That's a fitting and perfect end. Nothing about us without us. Thank you, Nancy. And again, I just really want to express my warmest appreciation to Alice, Teresa, Libby, Sadie, and Nancy for just being so insightful and helping us really expand our thinking and continue this process of learning, and also to our participants for being a part of the call. Before we stop, Liz, do you have any announcements for us?
I do, just a couple. First of all, I want to remind you that the next time we will be together, a multi-class affinity discussion will happen. We'll be Thursday, May 2nd, same time, 2 to 3:30 Central Time. And we have a keynote webinar coming up next month, Wednesday, April 17th. So make sure that those dates are on your calendar because we, of course, want you to join us. And I want to also let you know that the resources, there were several resources mentioned during our discussion today, and they will be added to the training materials and resource page of the protected ALC class pages. So look for them there if you weren't able to get them jotted down when they were mentioned. And then finally, be kind of ready for the evaluation from this discussion today that will come to your inbox just in the next couple of moments. And if you could take 2 minutes and fill it out, contribute your thoughts and comments about the discussion, we always really, really appreciate it. So watch for that. And I'll look forward to talking with you all again.
Thank you, Liz. And once again, I hope everyone on the call was as inspired and challenged and excited by this conversation as I was. Many thanks to everyone who spoke. And wishing everybody a happy International Women's Day tomorrow. This call is now over.